It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, today all eyes on the U.S. House of Representatives and that vote on the proposed Obamacare replacement bill. In just a moment, I'll be talking with the Des Moines Register's Jason Noble. He'll be telling us how Iowa's congressional delegation is lining up for or against that. But first, the end of another very busy week for Iowa lawmakers. Joining us with some of the highlights from the week, Iowa Public Radio legislative correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So bring us up to speed so much I see on my list here. Let's just get right to it. What happened at the State House this week?
Well, a number of bills that have been out there for a while advanced in one way or another. The bill to ban abortions after 20 weeks, that passed the Senate a little earlier. It was considered in a subcommittee in the House this past week. This is turning out to be more controversial than I thought it was going to be. I really thought that some of this abortion legislation was going to sail through now that the Republicans mm-hmm. had control of both chambers of the legislature. However, the 20-week ban was out there along with another bill that would have essentially banned abortion altogether. That bill did not advance. And some people were seeing the 20-week ban as something that could advance. However, it didn't initially. It didn't pass the committee in the House. Now it's back in that same committee again. There was so much sentiment for the stronger bill that helped work against passing the 20-week ban. And now also the Senate in the 20-week ban added some language exempting cases of fetal anomaly. Well, your really hardcore abortion opponents don't like that. They don't want those exceptions in the bill. So even though I thought that this was going to be a go, the manager of the bill in the House this past week said that it was not going to be easy to pass the bill. So that's mm-hmm. where that stands.
And just to be clear, this is primarily disagreements within the GOP with the Democrats left on the sidelines.
Oh, right. The Democrats oppose both of these bills.
Mm-hmm. Voter ID passes the Senate. Tell us a little bit more about progress there with that bill under the Republicans.
Well, it has now passed both chambers. Both the House passed it earlier. The Senate passed it just last night. But they made some changes, so it goes back to the House now before it can go to the governor. This bill seems pretty well greased. I don't think there's going to be too much trouble getting those changes approved in the House. One of the things the Senate did was to narrow the window for early voting. It's 40 days now that you can vote absentee or satellite voting or go to the county auditor to vote, and that's now limited to 21 days. And that's just another example the Democrats point to that say it's going to make it harder to vote.
Mm-hmm. Minimum wage, we've been talking about that for weeks. We have, four, maybe five counties in Iowa that have been raising the minimum wage, and the legislature working to undo that.
Right, and that one, that passed another hurdle today. It's already passed the House to say the counties can't do that, and the ones who have are going to have to rescind their higher minimum wages. So it's going through its paces. Like I said, it's passed the House. It passed a Senate committee this past week. I don't see that having too much trouble getting past the full Senate. At every stop along the way, Democrats say, well, okay, when are we going to raise the statewide minimum wage? In the Senate committee this past week, Senator Randy Feenstra, a Republican from Hull, said, sometimes they just keep giving openings for talking about raising the wage statewide. So Senator Feenstra said, this hodgepodge isn't good. We're going to do away with the ones that have raised their wage. And then he said something like, it would be good if we could raise the minimum wage in the future. Well, of course, Democrats jump all over that and
right.
say, yes, yes. And so when are we going to do that? But all along, I never thought there was much of a chance that the legislature was going to raise the statewide minimum wage, even though Governor Branstad has said he would support, he calls it a modest increase.
Mm-hmm. I see on the list here, the fireworks bill is making some progress in the legislature, too, so perhaps some changes there in time for 4th of July.
Well, this is a perennial issue. It keeps coming up, and it's basically a rural-urban split on that rural lawmakers want to be able to, for people to buy and set off fireworks in the state, and urban lawmakers not so much. And so the bill that they're considering now, in the past, they've considered, okay, well, let cities opt out of that. And that would have, you know, that would have been probably enough to get urban lawmakers behind it. But they're not quite going that far. They're saying that cities can opt out, can say they can't be used in the city, but they couldn't say they can't be sold in the city. So it's they're trying to reach a sweet spot there, and so far they have it. Although that bill did pass the Senate, and with the Republicans getting to control, I'd say there's probably a better chance this year that that's actually going to pass.
Mm-hmm. You filed a story this week, Joyce, about an ethics committee meeting where the Iowa House voted to reprimand a Koch brothers lobbyist. Tell us about that.
It was just the ethics committee in the House, not the whole House. But Drew Klein lobbies for Americans for Prosperity. He was really one of the most prominent people arguing for the collective bargaining bill earlier in the session that was so controversial. Then after that, you know, after that bill was approved, signed into law, the president of the Iowa Federation of Labor filed a complaint that Drew Klein had not registered as a lobbyist on that bill. That's one of the rules, House ethics rules. Very good reason for those rules. It makes it more transparent on who's behind some of this legislation. And he had not registered to lobby, even though he had been so prominent out there front and center arguing for the bill. So the labor leader filed an ethics complaint. The House Ethics Committee dealt with that this week. They agreed that he had violated the ethics rules, but that there was no malice involved. And so they could have banned him from lobbying in the future. Instead, they are sending him a letter of reprimand and saying, in effect, don't do this again.
Mm-hmm. Closely related to the collective bargaining bill, there's a workers' comp bill being worked on, limiting workers' compensation. Where's that at now?
Well, it's available for debate in the Senate, but there was no action this past week. Actually, it's been on the Senate calendar for a while. The House passed the bill, but they scaled it back quite a bit. So the Senate must decide whether to go along with those House changes or go with their full-fledged bill that they had initially. So I think that's probably some behind-the-scenes talk on that, on just how far the Senate might scale that bill back.
Mm-hmm. And I understand there's an update on Governor Branstad, and do we know more about when he will be moving to China to become U.S. ambassador to China?
The only thing that we heard this week is that there is now a list out in Washington of the ambassadors who are awaiting confirmation, and the governor is on that list. So he still said this past week that he's waiting to hear. He's hoping to be sort of coached on appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But that's still no real progress there. The governor did announce, though, this past week that his daughter, Allison, is going to be taking her family and moving to China as well. She's a third-grade teacher. She applied for a job with a Beijing International School. I don't know much about that. I think that's probably a school for the children of diplomats, what with thousands of diplomatic employees in a city like Beijing. At any rate, she and her husband and two children will be moving to Beijing with the Branstads, and she'll be teaching third grade there.
Mm. Before we go, Joyce, a look ahead to next week. What are you expecting?
Well, probably the big thing coming up next week is going to be the budget targets. You know, we're a month out of before ending the session, and there's been no real work done on the budget. As you know, the revenue projections were scaled back recently. And so now they can get right to work in earnest on the budget. They're promising to, when they say budget targets, I mean, they say, okay, this is what we're going to try to limit the budget to.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no doubt that it's going to be very difficult. It was already going to be a tight budget year. These revenue estimates have been scaled way back. And so there's probably going to be a little bit of shock value in that when they kind of say this is how much the budgets are going to have to be cut.
We still have several weeks before the recess, but any reason to believe that under this unified Republican government that the budget, this budget problem will be ironed out more smoothly?
Probably. probably it will. You won't have Democrats and Republicans butting heads up to adjournment and beyond.
Right. All right. Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
Just as a program note there, Joyce and I will be talking with Iowa lawmakers this coming Monday, next Monday, about two of the items that we mentioned there, the proposal that would ban most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and also the bill that would prohibit counties from setting their own minimum wage. That our discussion on Monday, Legislative Day, this coming Monday. We do hope you'll tune in and perhaps join in our discussion. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, all eyes on the U.S. House. That vote coming up on the proposed Obamacare replacement bill. We want to find out how Iowa's congressional delegation fits into that vote. Yay or nay, the four members of our congressional delegation. Jason Noble is with us, politics reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us and keeping our eyes on our screens. I see the AP has said the Republicans don't have the vote, the enough votes.
That's right. This has been obviously a very fluid situation for a week now. The latest and most current here is that they do not have the votes. And the last that I had saw was that House Speaker Paul Ryan was on his way to speak with President Trump to let him know the votes weren't there and see how they want to go. As we're talking here, Press Secretary in the White House, Sean Spicer, is delivering a press conference where I imagine he'll be kind of outlining the next steps. But it is an open question at this point if there's going to be a vote today, given that the yes votes aren't there to pass it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's nevertheless talk about how Iowa's congressional delegation lined up in this. Just to remind everyone, in our first district, Republican Rod Blum, Dave Loebsack, the only Democrat in the 2nd District in the southeast corner of the state, more or less. David Young in the 3rd District, and Steve King, our longest-serving congressman currently in the 4th District. Three Republicans, one Democrat. Did they all firmly commit to a vote on this?
Yes. As of within the last couple of days, we saw firm commitments from all four of them, and some pretty surprising.
Mm-hmm. The most surprising, let me guess, is Steve King, a yes vote, even though he's a Freedom Caucus member, and those are the ones who've been the defectors.
Yeah, you know, he for a very long time was sort of a leaning no. I think that everyone sort of expected that he would be a no vote on this because he is very conservative and has been a hardliner in opposition to the existing Affordable Care Act for a very long time. He changed his vote after a meeting on Wednesday with the president in the White House, in which he extracted some concessions And at this point, he would look to be a yes vote on this and the only one in the Iowa delegation.
Mm-hmm. So what about the two other Republicans, we could say more moderate Republicans in terms of the Republican Party, David Young in the 3rd and Rod Blum? What did they offer as reasons for their no votes if the vote should come today?
Right. Rod Blum in the 1st District, he is also a member of the Freedom Caucus, came out pretty early this week and said that he would be a no. I followed up with his staff just this morning, and they reiterated that he would remain a no, despite some very heavy lobbying over the last 24 hours. He, I think, like a lot of other Freedom Caucus conservative members of Congress, didn't feel like this went far enough in repealing the existing Affordable Care Act and bringing forward a more conservative approach that they see as driving down the cost of health insurance.
Mm-hmm. And David Young there in the central part of the state, including the Des Moines area.
Yeah, and to me, David Young's really the most surprising one on this. He came out as a no vote early in the week. He is definitely a more sort of moderate, sort of business class Republican, is seen as relatively close with the Republican leadership in the chamber. And so for him to differ with House Speaker Paul Ryan on this was very notable. And it even had some very immediate repercussions where a super PAC aligned with Paul Ryan said that they had plans to open an office here, to have a staffer on the ground to help out with his 2018 reelection campaign. And after his announcement that he would be a no on this vote, they are pulling that. And they're closing that office and pulling that staffer.
Yeah,
so,
well,
immediate political repercussions for this.
Yeah, we'll be talking about it if it indeed is a no vote, as would seem to be indicated at this hour. What else do you see for implications for the Iowa delegation or otherwise? What comes to mind here as far as, I mean, Donald Trump said, this is it. This is your only chance. I'm moving on after this. Now, we don't know if that's some gamesmanship, some of his famous negotiating skills, so to speak. But what do you see as implications?
You know, I don't know. This is the biggest thing that this Congress has taken on. It could end up being the biggest thing that this Congress will do or consider in 2 years of governing, and it has huge implications for what comes next. If this Congress is able to take on tax reform, if it's able to take on a big infrastructure bill, there's a question here on whether they can find consensus and get things done, and that affects everything that comes after. I mean, remember, this is something, repealing the Affordable Care Act is something they've been talking about for 7 years. It's been a campaign promise from Republicans since the day it passed. And they had their big chance. They control the presidency and both chambers of Congress, and they're apparently not able to do it.
Mm-hmm. And we know how many votes were taken that, in fact, in the House did vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, that was when President Obama was president. They knew it would have been vetoed, so it was a much easier vote to take, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. And those were bills to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but not necessarily to replace it with something else. And that has obviously proved to be the real sticking point here. It's finding a plan that replaces the Affordable Care Act, that pleases very conservative members and more moderate members who are looking at the benefits that have been put in place for their constituents and wanting to see some of those preserve.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the way Iowa's congressional delegation say they will vote in this upcoming vote on the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act with three no's and one yes, Steve King there, how much of these votes do you think was done with an eye toward 2018? Of course, our representatives in the House elected or not reelected every 2 years.
Yeah, you know, every member of Congress has re-election in mind, and every vote they take, they're thinking about how it affects their chances going forward. I think for David Young in the 3rd District in particular, he was looking at this and seeing the effect that it would have on a lot of his rural constituents, a lot of older constituents. Definitely the people that helped get him into office would be hurt by the changes that are proposed to the Medicaid program, to insurance on the individual exchange, and he made a calculation that was too high of a political price to pay. I think you look at Rod Blum and Steve King, and they made some more, you know, ideological or principled decisions on what they could support or what they couldn't within their sort of ideological view of things. Dave Loebsack, the lone Democrat in the delegation, obviously Democrats were united against this. The Affordable Care Act was the signature policy achievement for Democrats of the last generation. They're not going to be any part of opposing it.
Mm-hmm. But the Democrats haven't they shifted somewhat and said, you know, we're now open to, if you want to amend the Affordable Care Act, and that's been for some time, if you want to take that approach.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, obviously in a few years of implementation and operation here, there's been some questions about the law. Insurance premiums continue to go up. There's other issues that have arisen, and there's certainly an appetite there, I think, for amending the law to make it better, but not under these terms of repealing it and replacing it with something that affects coverage in a really visceral way for millions of people.
Mm-hmm. Jason, I know you've been concentrating on this health care repeal and replacement story here in Iowa. Are there other aspects of it that you're looking to cover now with this big vote day soon to be passed?
Well, I think this really has implications for the entire Republican agenda for the remainder of this congressional session. I mean, if they can't do this, then what sort of political capital, what energy do they have to take on some of the other big priorities that they've been talking about? What does this mean for, you know, the president's ability to push the Congress to take on his agenda? And what does it mean for the Republican Congress's ability to work together and get other priorities accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Okay, Jason Noble, politics reporter with the Des Moines Register. We'll keep up to date with you and our other sources, but thanks now for joining us, Jason Noble of the Des Moines Register.
Thank you, Ben.
Following that story from Washington, all eyes on the U.S. House, that vote on the proposed Obamacare repeal and replacement bill. We'll keep our eyes, and of course, it will be covered later on today, here and now, and of course, on All Things Considered, many developments yet to happen. Coming up in our next half hour, we want to talk with the about a new report that predicts an increase in cancer cases in Iowa this year. We'll get details on that. And also, Amy Mayer will be along. She'll be talking about Sonny Perdue. Now, Sonny Perdue is Donald Trump's pick to be our next Secretary of Agriculture, succeeding Tom Vilsack, a longtime governor and longtime Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama. Amy Mayer will be along to talk about his process of being put in that seat. And also, perhaps you got the alert a little bit earlier this week. It was Monday night, I remember, around 7 o'clock. There was a civil emergency alert sent out to many cell phones in Iowa. It happened to be a mistaken civil emergency alert. We'll find out what was behind that. And we talk with John Benson, a spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Homeland Security, that coming up in our second half hour. Let's take a moment before we go into our second half hour to listen to some original music created right here in Iowa. They call themselves Society of Broken Souls, and they're my guests this afternoon on Iowa Public Radio's Java Blend event. That's 2 o'clock at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. Lauren Chapter, and Dennis James from Fairfield. They call themselves Society of Broken Souls. You can tune in or come to our event at the Java House in downtown Iowa City, 2 o'clock this afternoon. And let's listen to a little bit of them. We'll be back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Livestock trailers rattling by, they don't see him there. This unknown foreign visitor from some other time, looking for to trespass or commit some kind of crime. He wanders through the halls just outside the empty rooms, with their windows shuttered tight against a cold November moon. The shadows in the corners from all they left behind, they bleed into the cracks of light that'll leave him nearly blind. Stealing back to yesterday when no one sees him leave, he slips the latch undone and closes the door so quietly. Cuts through fallow fields until he comes upon the track. He's leaving it all behind him, he ain't.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Maybe you got that alert. It was on Monday around 7 p.m. in the evening. It was on many cell phones of Iowans across the state. It said a civil emergency in this area until 8:45. Take shelter now. That was a mistake. We'll hear the story of the mistaken civil emergency alert that was sent out a little bit later in the program. Also, Amy Mayer will be along, our ag reporter. She'll tell us a little bit about how the confirmation hearings are going for President Donald Trump's pick to lead the U.S. Department of Agriculture, former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue. But first of all, it's estimated over 6,000 Iowans will die from cancer in 2017. That's according to a new report released this week by the State Health Registry of Iowa. It's based at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Dr. Mary Carlton joins me now to talk about the report and its findings. She is co-investigator with the Iowa Cancer Registry, also assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa. Dr. Carlton, Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what do you want to highlight in this latest report?
Well, basically that, you know, we were hoping cancer numbers were coming down a little bit in terms of new cases, and it looks like we're not making quite as much progress as we hoped. In the last couple of years, we had projected less than 17,000 people would be diagnosed with cancer, and with more recent numbers coming out, it looks like we could not lower our estimates and had to bump them back up to 17,400 new cases.
Yeah, what's the explanation for that, as far as you can see?
Well, in previous years, we're unfortunately using data that's a couple of years behind, because it takes us a couple of years to collect the data and the treatment and the survival outcomes for people. And we had hoped that colorectal cancer was coming down a little faster than it was, and we thought we might have seen signals of breast cancer coming down a little bit. But the most recent numbers we were looking at show they're remaining pretty stable and are not coming down as much as we'd hoped.
Mm-hmm. Liver cancer on the rise as well in this report. How much?
Well, it's roughly tripled back from when we started collecting cases back in 1975. And we think that's because a lot of the baby boomers who were born between 1945 and 1965 are kind of hitting the age where they may have been living with hepatitis C for many years, and mm-hmm. it's now developing into liver cancer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wonder, when we look at Iowa, and this is something that you look at every year, right, the Iowa Cancer Registry?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any correlations when we look at rates of certain types of cancer and where they occur in the state?
We haven't seen any, if you mean like cancer clusters or hotspots, no.
Right.
We do a lot of studies, especially Dr. Charles Lynch here in the Department of Epidemiology runs the Agricultural Health Study, and he enrolled thousands of farmers across Iowa, and they look very closely at correlations between pesticide exposure and things like that and cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just geography, we haven't seen any hotspots or clusters around the state.
What about any sort of rural-urban differences?
Sometimes there's differences in terms of when people present and what stage they have. There's a lot of thought that rural people maybe don't have as good as access to health care as urban people, and so they come in at a later stage of their cancer. But in terms of wide differences in rates of cancer, we don't see a lot of differences between rural and urban.
Mm-hmm. Your report also estimates that more than 17,000 new cancer cases will be diagnosed this year in 2017. What are the leading types of cancer in Iowa that will be diagnosed?
The leading type of cancer in women remains breast cancer, and in men, prostate cancer. Although the prostate cancer numbers do continue to come down because likely because the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended against PSA screening for prostate cancer, so we're seeing a lot fewer cases of that each year. The next one for both males and females is colorectal cancer, and that's one that I would really like to emphasize, screening and colonoscopy, because that's one that really can be prevented completely if it's detected when it's just in a polyp phase and can be removed, and then you never have to go on to develop cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in broad brushstrokes, what does this report have to say about our prevention efforts and our increased attention to cancer prevention?
I think it shows we've made progress, especially if I look over trends over time in the big four cancers, which would be breast, lung, colorectal, and prostate, but that they could be coming down a lot faster. A lot of those, especially, like I said, colorectal cancer, lung cancer. I think if we saw more preventive efforts with reducing smoking, we could see huge gains. I think that's where we've made most of the gains in our fight against cancer has been in smoking cessation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that definitely needs to continue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other lifestyle choices that are sort of low-hanging fruit, easy things to do as individuals to prevent cancer?
Yeah, definitely. One of the top five each year, and that keeps continuing to go up, is skin melanoma. And so really avoiding, using indoor tanning booths and using sunscreen when you go outside. Another one is we see a rise in oropharyngeal cancer in males, and a lot of that is HPV-related. So getting your kids vaccinated at age 11, which it may seem early to people, but there's a magic thing about age 11 where that HPV vaccine works the best and works the longest, and people need to think of it as a cancer prevention activity and not just a vaccine against an STD.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps before we go, Mary, a quick word about Well, we've reported on this program on Iowa Public Radio, you know, the tremendous strides in recent years in treating all types of cancer. These are really hopeful developments that mean when, you know, these more than 17,000 new cancer cases this year have a much better outlook than generations ago, don't they?
Absolutely. And even where we see some new cancer cases going up, we still see deaths coming down, which is a real testament to the treatment advances that we've made over the last several years.
Okay. Thank you very much for keeping us up to date. Dr. Mary Carlton, co-investigator with the Iowa Cancer Registry, assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa, talking about a new report released this week by the State Health Registry of Iowa, based in the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Dr. Carlton, Mary, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, President Donald Trump's pick to lead the U.S. Department of Agriculture, former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue, testified at a confirmation hearing in front of the Senate Agriculture Committee in Washington. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer covered the hearing. She joins me now. Hi, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
Who is Sonny Perdue? For those who don't know, tell us a little about him.
Sure. Well, Sonny Perdue was governor of Georgia from 2003 to 2011. Before that, he served in the Georgia legislature. Interestingly, he was first elected as a Democrat and then was later reelected as a Republican. Outside of politics, he had worked for decades in family-owned agribusinesses, grain elevators, transport companies, a couple of other things like that. And earlier on, he initially trained as a veterinarian.
Mm, okay. So he's a latecomer to the president's picks here, nominated, though, early January, this hearing taking place. It is March. Yes, I'm looking at the calendar. Why the delay?
It's been 2 months since he was nominated, and he was the last cabinet level position to be nominated, I believe. It's interesting, in the weeks in between his nomination and his confirmation hearings, one of the things that we heard, even from our own Senator Chuck Grassley, was that in the voluminous paperwork that a nominee has to file, which is then reviewed to look for conflicts of interest and ethics concerns and that sort of thing, it took Sonny Perdue a long time to unravel himself from all of his various agribusiness interests in order to be able to meet the requirements for the conflict of interest mm-hmm. and financial disclosure paperwork.
Did he end up finding remedies for these potential conflicts of interest?
As far as we know, when he was governor, he declined to put his own assets into a blind trust. But according to a review that the Reuters news agency did of this set of disclosure documents for Secretary of Agriculture, he has apparently arranged to, or at least agreed to, put his assets into a blind trust.
Okay, so you've been listening to that confirmation hearing this week in front of the Senate Agriculture Committee in Washington. What were the topics that senators were most interested in hearing from him about?
Several senators wanted to know what he would do as Ag Secretary to help the dairy industry. Milk producers have really struggled in recent years. Milk prices have been low, and some of the existing dairy safety net programs are, in many quarters, considered insufficient or inadequate, and mm-hmm. dairy doesn't get as much attention during the big farm bill negotiations as some of the other commodities do. So senators from New York State and Vermont, but also from other places, were asking about dairy. Related to that, in addition to safety net programs for dairy, several senators raised the question of immigration, and in particular the H-2B visa program, which allows for agricultural workers, but currently only seasonal workers. And of course, a dairy farmer needs help on the farm year-round, and currently he cannot or she cannot hire immigrants using the H-2B program for those year-round dairy jobs, and that's something they would like to see changed.
Mm-hmm. On those topics, any surprises to you about statements from Sonny Perdue?
No, not particularly. He grew up on a dairy farm, so he had a great understanding for the 24/7 nature of dairying. On immigration, he did seem a little more open to and maybe even committed to finding some resolutions to agricultural immigration mm-hmm. Worker issues. But that's something that within ag that's within the realm of what agriculture has been pushing for.
Mm-hmm. I believe the next farm bill is due in 2018. That discussed?
Yes, for sure. And it is due in 2018. Hearings have already begun for it. And although the Farm Bill is a largely legislative process, Sonny Perdue did commit whatever resources he might have at his disposal at the USDA to help, I think his words were, create and write and create or create and improve policies in the farm bill. So he definitely came out as someone who wanted to be an advocate for and also a partner in the creation of an on-time farm bill.
Mm-hmm. The RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard, very important to Iowa since we built up all this infrastructure to make ethanol, for instance, from some of the corn that we grow here. Was that discussed?
It did come up, yes. And although the RFS doesn't fall directly under USDA, there are certain aspects of it that USDA is involved with. And Sonny Perdue said that he would be a strong advocate for the RFS. President Trump has also expressed his support of the RFS, although he has come under some pressure from, in particular, the petroleum industry to make some changes to the RFS. I think Sonny Perdue tried to make it clear that his intention would be to support corn growers and farmers and the ethanol industry for RFS.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Iowa, very dependent on open trade around the world, and this president taking a different tact than the Obama presidency, other presidents before us, too. So was there talk about open trade and perhaps the implications for Iowa's tremendous corn supplies and other exports, pork and so forth?
Trade came up repeatedly in the hearing. One of the senators said that when she met individually with Perdue ahead of the hearing, he won her over by stating his first three priorities as trade, trade, and trade. So he did come out clearly in support of promoting American agricultural products abroad. He referred to the global middle class being hungry for U.S. agricultural products. And he emphasized Cuba and that he had taken a delegation to Cuba some time ago, hoping that relationships could be improved in a way that would allow the Cubans to have access to the financing they need to buy American products. And he also referenced the need for a tenacious advocate on trade for the agriculture industry and said that if he is confirmed, one of his first meetings would be with the U.S. trade representative.
Mm-hmm. If we put this all in a nutshell, going from Tom Vilsack to Sonny Perdue at this point, with him not even yet confirmed, but could you say to a farmer who asked you or someone else in the ag industry, so what will be the difference between a Sonny Perdue and a Tom Vilsack?
Tom Vilsack was certainly a bridge builder in the administration, particularly with the Republican Congress, because on many ag issues, Vilsack, even as a Democrat, was able to agree or find common ground with some of the congressional Republican leaders. Obviously, at least in these first 2 years, Sonny Perdue won't be called upon to do that sort of thing. But Vilsack also had a deep and strong understanding of the grain markets and the grain concerns that farmers here in the Midwest and Corn Belt have. Sonny Perdue's background is slightly more in animal agriculture. Georgia's obviously a much bigger poultry state for meat birds rather than the commodities that we have most here in Iowa. So in that sense, there's a little bit of concern that he may have a little more emphasis on cotton, for example, than we've seen in the past. But overall, I would just say if Vilsack was a Democrat who was able to lean Republican or build bridges with Republicans, we don't know yet whether, should the Congress change in the midterms, if Perdue would be that kind of bridge builder. But he certainly tried to present himself as someone who will work across the aisle.
Okay, you focused in on the confirmation hearings of Sonny Perdue this week. Any idea, any indication when the vote will happen on his confirmation, and will there be any reason for him not to be confirmed?
The Senate Ag Committee could take a vote sometime next week. It's not clear whether they will. And then after that, it would have to go to the full Senate. But there are no indications that he's any kind of trouble. The confirmation is expected.
Okay. Amy Mayer, our ag reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
You're welcome.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday, maybe you heard that alert. It was around, well, just after 7 in the evening, Monday of this week. I know I did. I got that text on the cell phone. It read, civil emergency in this area until 8:45 p.m. Take shelter now, Polk County. It turns out there was no civil emergency. That was a mistake, that notification. John Benson is with us, spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Hi, John.
Ben, good to talk to you. How are you doing today?
Good. So I don't know how many Iowans got it. I got it. My wife got it. A lot of other people. I got calls. I was like, I guess I work in the news business. I'm supposed to be connected to these things. I said, I don't know what it's about. I don't see any severe weather. What happened, John?
Well, it was part of an ongoing effort with the folks in Johnson County. The initial incident they were working was actually a missing person. And earlier in the day, they had sent out some text messages and phone calls via this system called Alert Iowa, which we administer across the state. They hadn't located the individual, so at 7 o'clock, they did decide to utilize what's referred to as the Wireless Emergency Alert System, which is part of FEMA's Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. EAS, the Wireless Emergency Alerts, NOAA weather radios kind of fit under that umbrella. So Johnson County actually reached out to the vendor that provides the Alert Iowa system for us and worked on a message, got the message right, and it actually ended up being operator error, if you will. When they went to submit this message into the FEMA system, a couple of the key elements were missing out of it, weren't filled in correctly, and that caused the message to come out wrong. Since it went out under our license, which we can cover the entire state, that caused the Polk County part of the message to happen. Mm-hmm. And then the civil emergency, if you don't, there's a bunch of different type of messages you can issue out of there, and if you don't select the right one, in this case, which it would have been a missing person, it'll default to that civil emergency. So that led to the problem of the message actually going out and going out the way that it did, and it did hit Johnson County, hit part of Iowa County, and actually hit a couple of cell towers over here in Polk County. So it kind of hops and skipped around the state. But on the plus side, as you correctly noted, you certainly paid attention to the message. It, you know, made you wonder what was going on. Just wish we would have had the right message on it.
Right. You have any idea in those counties that you named how many people's cell phones were erroneously alerted?
I can't give you a hard number, but what the WEA message does is it reaches out to any cell phone, or it's not any cell phone, but really a smartphone. That is referred to as WEA-enabled. And so, you know, your iPhones, your Galaxies, all of those type of smartphones that run on those type of systems would have received the message. And it doesn't require that a person be registered or anything like that. The system's really built to handle three different type of messages: presidential-oriented messages, Amber Alerts, which people are probably most familiar with getting, and then these extreme or severe weather or situation, imminent threat type of situations, which is the one reason that Johnson County was using. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, civil emergency, this phrase right there, I guess, it made it clear to me. I don't know all the things that might entail. What could, if you got a real civil emergency alert, what could that mean?
Well, it could mean a wide variety of things. You could be talking about some type of civil disturbance occurring. Maybe there's something hazardous materials oriented happening in your immediate area that would necessitate that message going out. The real intent behind any of those messages is, and as you know, they're only about 90 characters long, so you really can't put a lot of detail in there, but you want to hit some high elements in terms of what is the immediate emergency, and then kind of drive them towards other media sources, be that radio, TV, internet, to get further detail on it. But it's certainly something, when it does happen, we want people to pay attention to mm-hmm. it.
Have steps been taken to avoid this, what you said, operator error happening again?
Yep, actually we did. We sat down the day after it happened with the vendor and said, listen, we need to kind of put a fail-safe into the software. And so what the software does now is, unless you've got all of those particular items filled out and completed, it won't allow the message to go forward. So, you know, a lot of times people are familiar with PayPal. If you don't get the credit card in right, it won't let it go forward until you get it right. So we've kind of put those same safeguards in place now as well to ensure that we don't have those type of situations in the future.
Even though this is an isolated incident, do you worry? I guess, John, you must worry at the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management that repeated this happening again and again would damage confidence in the alert system. Absolutely.
Well, yes, and it's even more direct than that, Ben, is the problem we're very cognizant of is the boy who cried wolf syndrome, if you mm-hmm. will. We only want the system going off in very limited situations where it's very important and it's requiring the public to react in some type of way to an ongoing incident. So we only want it used in very limited, very select cases. And so we want to also make sure that we don't have an incident like we had this last time around. We want people to pay attention. So when we issue a message, they know it's something very important.
Okay. Thank you very much for that bit of explanation. John Benson talking about the erroneous civil emergency alert that was hit many cell phones in Iowa that told people to take shelter. It was a mistake. John Benson, spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Thanks for clearing up that for us and telling us the story behind it, John.
Ben, thanks for the conversation today.
Okay. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury, and we had help from Chelsea Hoy. Monday on the program, Iowa Public Radio Statehouse correspondent Joyce Russell and I will talk with Iowa lawmakers about two bills making their way through the Republican-controlled legislature. We hope you'll join us for that conversation. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.